Cannabis Business Minds, we train and mentor professionals, entrepreneurs, and aspiring entrepreneurs on how to confidently find their place in the legal cannabis and hemp industries. Come on and join us at CannabisBusinessMinds.com. Today I have with me Brian Vicente. He's a founding member of Vicente Law Firm. He is based out of Denver, which is where the law firm is based. And as you know, I work out of the Boston office. So Brian, why don't we start by you telling our listeners a little bit about yourself, Vicente, and your background?
Sure. Well, glad to be here. So I'm an attorney and I've been working in the cannabis space for, this is my 19th year full time, which is sort of makes me a bit of a dinosaur. I live out here in Colorado, but our law firm has offices across the country. And really was brought to cannabis policy by just a deep belief that the war on drugs was a failure, and then did a lot of work defending medical marijuana patients, people dying of cancer and AIDS, you know, back in the kind of early mid 2000s, and was fortunate enough to play a pretty big role in a lot of the changes that we saw in Colorado on the, both on the medical side and on the adult use side. And then have kind of built up a law firm around that, where we continue to advise governments as well as, you know, probably 1,000 cannabis and ancillary clients coast to coast.
So you talk about the work that you did in Colorado. Take us back to 2008. Medical cannabis is being legalized. You and your colleagues are in the forefront of the campaign. What are you thinking? Like, what is the crux of the campaign? Did you think it, you know, what's your vision? Take us back a little bit to 2008.
Sure. First, I'm going to take you back further in our time machine to 2000. That's when the Colorado's medical marijuana law passed, right? So, but it was definitely a slow burn of a medical marijuana law for many years. And then 2007, 2008, I sued the state health department. That was the individuals that were responsible for implementing the medical marijuana program. On behalf of a guy who weighed less than 100 pounds, he's an AIDS patient, very ill, and he wanted to get medical cannabis legally from a caregiver, like a human being, flesh and blood person. This is before the days of stores, right, dispensaries. And the state denied him and said, hey, this caregiver is already helping five people. They've registered as such. You can't, you know, can't get medicine from them. You know, go to the black market, you sick person. And, you know, that was nowhere in law that this individual could only help five people and couldn't help my client. So we sued the state and we won. And that not only had the effect of allowing my client to purchase medicine from this trusted caregiver, a person he knew and he trusted the medicine that was putting in his body, it also allowed caregivers to help an endless number of people. Right. And if you can help 1,000 individuals legally under the state law, you can open a store. Right? If you can only help five people, it's a very limited store. So that really led to like an explosion of the storefront model in Colorado based off that lawsuit. And then I got very involved at the Capitol here in Denver, trying to convince the legislature to not prohibit these new stores and in fact go ahead and regulate them. And that's what they did in really 2009, 2010. And that was a pretty remarkable step because that was the first state regulatory authority to say, hey, the court said this okay, but we're actually okay with it ourselves. And we're going to, as members of the health department and the state legislature, we're actually going to regulate this new industry, right? So it never really happened in history.
So as a former legislator, I know there's sometimes a disconnect between court cases and legislation. Mm-hmm. Did you have a lot of pushback the first time up to the Capitol?
We did, yeah. I mean, I think people were, it was definitely one of those, they're either going to ban this forever or they're going to regulate it moments, right? And there was a lot of education that needed to be done. I was at the Capitol pretty much every day for an entire legislative session, which is, you know, quite an affair. And, you know, a lot of different hearings, and we had to coordinate testimony and all this stuff. But you know, at the end of the day, it's like these stores had been up and running for a couple years. Yes, there was a lot of them, you know, hundreds that kind of, you know, ostensibly came out of nowhere, but here they were for a couple years. And you know, once cannabis is being regulated and these are shop owners. They're trying to pay taxes. They're trying to employ people. They're trying to give back to their community. And they became organized. That sent a message to these legislators. And really, I think we did a number of things that contributed to this positive result of regulating versus prohibiting. But one of those was taking legislators to stores so they could, look in the eyes of a medical marijuana patient and talk to the budtender and see, these aren't individuals that should lose access. In fact, we should codify this access.
So did you know then that this would become a national movement and that this policy would span the entire country?
Yeah, my
Did
crystal
you think
ball
your
was
one court
becoming
case?
clear. It certainly struck me that if you can buy, every other medicine you can buy from a Walgreens or a CVS, you should be able to buy cannabis as a patient, right? And it just seemed to be working. By that time, you had other states starting to adopt this model. They could look to Colorado to see how it was being regulated at the state level from an adult use, or excuse me, from a medical perspective. You had, and at the same time, you have medical cannabis just growing in popularity in terms of public viewpoints year over year, right, in polling and so forth. So it seemed like we were headed on the right trajectory. I hoped that this would turn into broader access for all adults, and we ultimately were able to accomplish that several years later. It was a little tough to predict at the time.
So then your law firm was born out of Denver. Take us through how the law firm came to be, the role it played in, the national cannabis policy movement, and sort of where you are in 2023 and some of the things you're doing for your clients.
Yeah, so our, prior to really that state level medicalization where you had those stores, I was basically working for a nonprofit, and which I was the head of, and it's a very small nonprofit. And then also just doing private work on behalf of clients and patients and doing these impact lawsuits. But once it became clear in 2009, 2010 that we would have state laws to really, begin having legitimate businesses, or licensed, became clear to me I needed to kind of broaden my horizon. I'd essentially been like an almost a criminal defense lawyer because there was no cannabis laws other than cannabis criminal laws prior to that, to our state passing these regulatory laws. So I kind of reached out to just folks in my network. I hooked up with Christian Cederberg, who was my partner for many years. I hooked up with Josh Kappel, who's still my partner. These were attorneys on the ground in Colorado, who had different backgrounds, in business law, regulatory law, admin law, and we were able to kind of form a team to provide, advice and guidance to these new business owners. So we have been kind of off and running ever since, and then we remain quite busy here in Colorado, but we have about 100 folks spread out throughout the country, pretty big offices in LA, Denver, Boston, New York, and we also have some folks in Florida and Michigan and Missouri and other fun places. We continue to be a unique animal in that all we do is advise clients and governments on cannabis laws and psychedelic laws, right? And sort of advise them on how they can start businesses in this space. So it's very active. Very soon, actually, Oklahoma might become the 22nd state to legalize cannabis by the time this podcast airs. So things are always moving, and we try to kind of stay on the cutting edge.
And I know as a former regulator, one of the things I tell people is the visual of my first day, five new commissioners, five cubicles, the restrictions of an open meeting law. You can't talk to each other. Who do you turn to, right? And a lot of cannabis regulators are political appointments, so they're not necessarily people who come from the industry. And Vicente has certainly provided a very thoughtful and a very strategic voice throughout the country when it comes to regulatory process, good regulations, the balance between industry and government, given the fact that we have no federal support system, which is oftentimes important to businesses in general. So it's been interesting to work in the Boston office. I think we have a very robust Boston office that does a lot of work here on the East Coast. But as the industry has moved forward, what do you see, given your background, given all the work that you've done in cannabis? What is the future of cannabis?
you know, is it many people listening to this podcast could still be interested in getting into the business? Is it too late? Are there still opportunities for people to get in moving forward?
Yeah, I mean, that's the fun thing. I think it's still pretty early stage. I mean, we have, you know, really only laws have just been passing in this space about medical or recreational use since 1996. We still only have 21 states with legal cannabis for adults, and then, you know, a dozen or so more that have medical marijuana. But a lot of these are really early stage markets, and they're still, you know, 29 states that have yet to legalize cannabis at all. And then, of course, there's international opportunities. And by and large, the rest of the globe has been a little behind the United States, but, you know, we have legal cannabis in Uruguay, and we have other kind of provinces, municipalities moving forward, maybe Germany very soon. So I think we're still at the early wave of this, and that makes it exciting, because I think there's an opportunity for people to impact these laws and this cannabis economy in a positive way. I mean, we have an opportunity. Do we want to be Philip Morris, or do we want to be sort of a more thoughtful, community-oriented industry, right? And I think there's a lot of people that prefer the latter, and, you know, believe in the medical side of this, believe in the job production side, believe in the social equity side of cannabis licensing. And so I think there's tons of opportunity. You know, I'm involved in a fairly robust effort to try to legalize cannabis in 10 states in the next 3 years. We believe that that will create the kind of necessary pressure to get the federal government to move. They've been very slow on cannabis since the 60s, I guess. I mean, a lot of us thought that once the Democrats controlled the House and the Senate and the executive with Biden, that we'd see, you know, big reforms on cannabis. That has not been the case. The only big reforms we've seen ever are at the state level. So we're leading an effort with the Marijuana Policy Project, which is a pretty prominent nonprofit in this space, to really try to flip another 10 states to adult use, which will not only, of course, provide job opportunities, business opportunities in those states, and stop arresting individuals in those states, which is really important. I think it'll also create some political muscle. You know, if you have individuals, representatives, senators coming from those states, including Florida and Ohio and Pennsylvania, these big states, to DC, I think it's gonna be a lot tougher for them to vote to uphold federal prohibition when across the street from their home office is a dispensary. So I think we're going to continue to see change. And I think we're several years away from federal legalization, but we're on that path.
Do you find that there are more legislators that understand the issue, or do some of these states that haven't legalized yet still, you know, have some of the notions and the rhetoric that happened over the last, you know, 4 or 5 decades?
Yeah, I mean, this cannabis reform has always been a citizen-led effort, right? You know, it's rare that you have elected officials lead on cannabis reform. And that, unfortunately, has not changed a ton in the couple decades I've been working on this issue. You know, we have seen cannabis legalized in via state legislatures, as opposed to the ballot, in a handful of states, right, including Virginia and including Illinois and some other, you know, pretty prominent states. But by and large, it's the citizens that are leading this. But, you know, I think we increasingly you have legislators that are getting out of their beltway, if you will, and are beginning to realize, hey, there's either, you know, cannabis stores in my hometown, or perhaps in when I'm at a conference, I'm seeing cannabis stores and the world isn't ending. Maybe I should talk to legislators from those states and figure out, you know, what's going on. Perhaps so I think we're piercing the bubble of ignorance that legislators have around this issue, or maybe it's just indifference. They just don't care. You know, kind of state by state, battle by battle. And I think we're winning some legislators over. And, you know, we have some pretty prominent advocates in DC, you know, Cory Booker and Chuck Schumer, you know, Dave Jost on the from Ohio. You know, you have these bigger name folks. They haven't seemed to accomplish progress yet, but, you know, the fact that they're speaking in behalf of cannabis, I think is important.
Yeah, it's always interesting. There's an assumption that state legislators know a lot about everything, when a lot of times you just have people running for office who want to take care of their communities and learn as they go along. So I know even in Massachusetts, when the ballot question came up and then all of a sudden we were faced with what to do with the language, it was certainly a trial by fire in learning all there is to know. And we still don't know everything there is to know. I often joke that I can't grow an aloe plant, yet when I go into a grow facility, it's like a NASA investment on their wall. And how do they possibly operate that when I'm killing my little aloe plant at my house?
Yeah, there's a science there.
Oh my goodness, it's a science that I will never understand. So what are some of the challenges you think this industry is going to face in the next 5 years? Generally, like, what should operators be looking at? I know Casey's talked a lot about compliance when I had her on the podcast, and how compliance is really going to be a big deal when it comes down to record keeping and recording. But are there major topic areas that operators should be looking at, or people trying to get into the industry?
Sure. Well, this is certainly a bit of a tough time for the industry, right? I mean, it's funny, there's a lot of discussion nationally about, oh, inflation's going to, you know, make the price of groceries higher and all this stuff, which is happening. And we're totally unique as an industry that we're actually facing like deflation. Like everywhere you go, the cost of cannabis is dropping, you know, like a ton of bricks. So that is having ripple effects right throughout this industry, right? Whether you're a wholesaler or retail or what have you. I mean, I was at lunch with a pretty prominent retailer the other day. They have 20 some stores. I mean, it's really, they're getting the same number of customers. It's just the ticket price is so much lower, because they're selling ounces for $100 instead of $300, you know, and it's just, it's impacting a lot of different businesses. So, you know, I think a lot of this is the natural course of a new industry. You know, the states, as you know, are just really regulating cannabis in many different ways. Some are like Oklahoma and will allow thousands of people to have business licenses. Some are like Ohio, where there's only 62 stores in the whole state. And so that is a very different value of that license, right? If you're in a limited market versus non. And, you know, how much cannabis is being grown in your state? I mean, it's just really impacting kind of everything. So I think a lot of regulators and business owners are trying to figure out, you know, what is the appropriate path to kind of make sure these businesses remain viable? Is it just pure capitalism? Should there be some government intervention to limit the numbers of licenses? What tax rate makes sense? You know, what renewal costs? I mean, you know, we're dealing with an application for a new business in Florida right now, where the application itself is $125,000 non-renewable. Maryland's looking at doing something similar for like conversion from medical to recreational. So these are giant hits to cannabis business owners that you know, we just need to keep an eye on and think about whether these are reasonable or not. So with the doom and gloom out of the way, I think the future is actually really bright. I mean, we're going through a tough cycle, but there are positive changes looming. You know, I believe that we will continue to broaden and add new state markets. I think we'll get Oklahoma, Minnesota, and Ohio all in 2023 to legalize cannabis. And we'll see Hawaii and maybe some other fun states the year after. So it's, you know, those are new markets. Those are new opportunities for individuals in those states. If I'm an MSO, I can look at those new markets and whether or not to enter. If I'm a lawyer or a service provider, you know, a CPA, or I sell, you know, soil, you know, these are new markets that you can look to enter. So I think, you know, keeping an eye on expansion opportunities is one thing we advise clients to do. You know, we still haven't found the kind of Starbucks of cannabis yet, you know, the product that you can get that's the same in Seattle versus Dayton, Ohio. And, you know, who is that going to be? Is it going to be cookies? I don't know. You know, like who's going to kind of break through there? So thinking about branding, and then I do think we'll see positive changes at the federal level. I think Biden, I would be shocked if he didn't pass some sort of comprehensive banking reform and maybe 280E, right. Probably banking, prior to his next election. I mean, he's a political enough animal that he's got to give this industry some sort of cookie, you know? So I think there's positivity on the horizon, but it's not an easy field to work in at this moment, but I hope people can hang in there.
Well, I think, you know, you mentioned it too, the ancillary businesses, right? So who's helping to get the cannabis businesses stood up? And that's people who are working on the buildings that they're actually leasing or buying. Which is an opportunity in many instances, not only for just communities that cannabis operators are going to site in, but also social equity applicants and also social equity businesses that we can help make this sort of, I mean, I deem it as the next workforce. We yeah. always look at labor. We look at, you know, different types of workforce. Cannabis is a workforce. There are thousands of people across the country working in this industry. And how do we maximize that benefit for people who may be a plumber or a painter or an electrician or what have you?
Yeah, it's the secondary economic impact too, right? Tech companies, you know, all the lawyers, all the people that service this industry. And yeah, there's tens of thousands of direct employees in Colorado that just work on cannabis issues, hundreds of thousands nationally. So it's fast growing, right? Unlike a lot of industries that are being shipped abroad or whatever, you know, this is something that's, you know, it's very domestic, and we should support that.
And it can't be even shipped to the next state. This is your guaranteed industry in the United States.
Exactly. I ain't going to Taiwan, that's for sure.
There is nothing being shipped overseas for this. Legally, I should say. We do catch the people who are trafficking, but legally it's not being sent overseas.
Yeah.
So since you've been a pioneer in the cannabis movement, you know, you and your team service clients across the country. What's next? I mean, there always is something on the horizon. What do you see coming down the pipeline that people maybe want to pay much attention to?
Yeah, you know, a couple things. I mean, you spoke about, you know, different avenues for people to enter the industry. And I think that's important, right? Because we're all trying to figure out, you know, how do we make sure that those have been disproportionately impacted by the drug war and cannabis prohibition in particular? How can they enter this area when it costs $125,000 to even apply to get a license in Florida, right? You know, and so we need to be conscious of that. But the good thing is there are different licensing opportunities. You know, when I and my couple colleagues wrote Colorado's legalization law, and you know, we kind of set up a framework, which has been copied by many states, Massachusetts, et cetera, in part. And that really just allowed for a couple license types. You're vertical, right? You grow, you sell, you process, there's a testing license. But the good news is a lot of new states have built on that. And you look at New York or Minnesota, they're considering like dozens of license types, right? And I think that's good because they're more accessible to individuals who aren't super wealthy. So some of that, like two that jump out to me, it's like delivery. You know, if I have a car, that's a lot cheaper of a startup cost for my business than building out a 100,000 square foot warehouse to grow in. You know, it's much more accessible. And the same with hospitality. I think that's really something that we're starting to scratch the surface of, you know, coffee shops and consumption lounges and things that, you know, there's really only a handful of in the country. But there's definitely a cheaper point of entry there. Then again, starting a giant processing lab. So those are a couple things. I mean, we also, in the last several years, our firm has begun doing a lot of work on psychedelics. We actually wrote Denver's psychedelic mushroom law, which then buoyed the statewide effort, which passed here last November, which legalized psilocybin mushrooms statewide. And right now you have Colorado and Oregon. That's really just two states that have these, you know, business opportunities and wellness opportunities for psilocybin and other natural medicines. But I think that's going to spread everywhere. I mean, it's similar to medical marijuana. There is actual, you know, palliative assistance that individuals can get and just, you know, health and wellness aspects of all these natural medicines that we're only beginning to tap. And, you know, that not only helps individuals, but that helps, you know, business owners and prospective business owners. And that's who our company exists to serve.
And I think it's important, too, that, you know, people, this is a medicine. I mean, this is an opportunity for people to utilize it as a medicine. You take the policy or the political conversations, it goes back and forth, right? Some people think those that use cannabis are in one category. Some don't even believe that it is a medicine. It's just a continuously policy and I think more political discussion than anything. And as we see, I think there's like multiple states across the country that have psychedelics as a piece of legislation. And we'll see how fast that moves through the legislatures. Hopefully alongside cannabis.
Yeah, that's right. I mean, I think some of, you know, I've been fortunate to be involved in, you know, Colorado was the first state to legalize adult use cannabis. And it kind of just showed the world that there was an alternative to prohibition. And so when we passed the mushroom law here just, you know, 6 months ago, I think once again, it like showed other legislators as well as other, you know, just citizens around the globe, like, hey, you can do something besides just keep mushrooms illegal in your community. And here's what Colorado's doing. Here's what Oregon's doing. So there's a model, right? And yeah, we have, I think it's like 30 state legislators considering psilocybin measures this year. It's really remarkable, as well as much globally.
It'll be interesting to watch the state legislatures as they move through the next sessions in the next couple of years.
Yeah, hot topics.
Well, Brian, thank you so much for coming on the podcast. I really appreciate it. Do you have any last word of wisdoms for people trying to get into the industry, people that may want to contact you for services or questions?
Yeah, I think, my advice is pretty simple, which is to show up. You know, if there's a meeting happening in your community about trying to change laws or at the legislature, something like that, you know, you don't have to be the smartest person in the room. Lord knows I rarely was. You just kind of have to keep showing up. And if it's something you're passionate about, you're going to learn along the way and you're going to create a community and you'll find different opportunities to not only participate in making laws better, but also in business opportunities. So, so thanks for your time. And we'd love to hear from you guys at VicenteLLP.com.
Thanks so much, Brian, for having us.
All right. My pleasure. Take care.
Thanks so much for listening to this week's show. Please subscribe wherever you get your podcasts. And if you enjoyed this, leave us a 5-star review. Make sure that you share this episode on your social media and tag us in the Instagram stories. You can find us wherever you go on social media. Just look up Cannabis Business Minds. Have an idea for the show or something that you want to talk about? Shoot us an email at podcast@cannabisbusinessminds.com.